Welcome, everybody. Nice to see you all. I would like to introduce our case writer and moderator, Judy Rakowski. Judy leads the Crisis Practice in Liberty Square Group. Her focus is helping clients develop and implement strategy and message in the face of threats to brand and reputation. A lot of people can do that. Let me explain where I think Judy is very unique and why you need to go up to New Hampshire and go to a tattoo parlor and tattoo Judy's email onto your wrist. Judy has spent years as an award-winning reporter and editor for the Boston Globe and the Providence Journal. But a lot of people that do what Judy do have had that experience. I think what really sets Judy apart is that she's also worked for People Magazine, the Columbus Citizen Journal, and the Plain Dealer. Because obviously the rest of this country and the rest of the world is not like New England. And it's really important to have a good regional flavor as well as a national flavor. And Judy has both of those. So I'm delighted to have her here. And she is going to be listening to your comments and then commenting on the comments. And so why don't we get to it? And let's see. I've got the first group consisted of Brian, Elizabeth, Lara, and Mindy. Do you have a moderator who would report to the rest of us?
Yes, Liz McLean here. I'm our moderator for group one. So we just felt the case lacked enough information. We didn't feel we had enough to make strong decisions one way or another, but we did feel we wanted more information, right? And how do we get more information out of a more subdued board and a CEO that felt that they had this? We felt we needed to go to a higher authority to find out what the liability was of this. We didn't feel we understood the liability. There was a mention of insurance. We didn't understand what that was. So we thought that higher authority might be outside counsel to sort of lay out the facts of the case for us through some kind of checklist that we would end up with. Do we have the proper certifications? Do we have actually insurance that would cover everything we're talking about? An actual employee death of the building itself, everything around how they came to the conclusion that the fire was actually our fault, right? Was it really RAC's fault at all? It just said there was a fire in the lab, that could be an electrical fire. That could be a lot of different places that the fire could actually start. After we sort of got this liability in place, we would take this and rally to evoke a crisis management plan. That crisis management plan should outline exactly the steps we follow in terms of communication, next steps on who the CEO should be talking to, how the CEO should be informing the board, what's happening in the next 24 hours, the next 48, the next week, the next month. It should all be laid out very strategically, but we also need to be authentic and empathetic, right? There was a death here. We have an employee death of the building. We have our own employees to think about. We also have the community to think about. This was a small business that landed in the middle of the community, and now it just blew up the community, right? Literally, it had fire and it killed someone. So to have that narrative out there, we want to be able to change that narrative. Right now, the narrative was written for us. It was RAC's at fault. You know, we're a terrible company, and we, you know, it wasn't, so we want to get back to controlling that narrative through this process.
Okay, thank you very much, Elizabeth. The group two is Kevin, Marianne, Phil, and Pam.
Hi, and I got selected as moderator, Pamela Goldberg. And what we were talking about is more about some of the same things that we've heard already, but also talking about how leadership in a company and boards should be doing risk mitigation all the time and thinking about what risk profiles are and how to address. And you cannot possibly anticipate every kind of risk, but like the point of insurance that was raised, and is there sufficient coverage? And that should be something that's driven both by the leadership in the company, but also the board. And so what are both groups doing together to address potential risks and mitigate those risks? But we also had a similar response about getting advice of counsel as to how to address the challenge that's in front of us, and have that communication among board and leadership, followed by the hiring of a PR firm to be able to tell the story in the best possible way.
Thanks very much, Pam. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you.
Room three is Bob, George, and Judy.
Hey, Bob here. I got elected because Vivek had to leave, and George is going to leave, and Judy, who is a fantastic contributor, is the case person. So it got to me. Judy made a comment at the very beginning when introducing herself. She said she gets hired in crisis communications after companies let things happen to them. Very often that's the way she gets called. And I immediately had a reaction to that, that said that was a kind of immediately a very passive situation in which when you let things happen to you, you're saying almost by the definition of those words that, you know, we weren't really fully in control of everything we were managing as a board. We were, if in fact the philosophy is we let things happen to us, it means we didn't really cover all of our bases. We didn't find out about all of the insurances. We didn't find out maybe about all of the risks. And so one of the issues was, should there, and this is not just an advertisement for Judy, but for boards in general, why is there not ongoing public relations, you know, for a company and a community that says, hey, you know, look, we're here, we're a good employer, the products that we think are going to come out are going to be something that you're going to like. We provide, jobs, businesses to business to other sub-businesses that we use, suppliers to vendors and things of this sort. So when something happens to you that suddenly it says, oh, RAC blew up, who are they? You know, what a bad bunch of people, you know, in our community, when in fact they may have been the very good people in the community that had a terrible accident. And, so that was one of the things that we talked about. The other thing that we talked about was, why was the venture capitalist called first on the board as opposed to the whole board? And having spent a lot of time, you know, from my perspective in the venture capital community, the venture capital people sometimes have a couple of different bifurcated interests. One is they sit on the board of a company and it's, hey, let's go board, let's go company, let's grow it, let's make it happen. And that's their role as a board member. And on the other hand, representing the venture capital community, it's like, I have my $5 million or whatever it is invested in this company, and I can't go back to my company at any time and say that $5 million is now worth $4 million. So I am protecting my the company, saying, we give us 6 more months, and the venture capital saying, yeah, but that's gonna cost me another $1 million. And I have seen that, and I've been in the center of conversations about that, about the advantages and disadvantages of having the venture capital person on the board, who ironically, and we don't know exactly why, was the first person called. Another issue that came up was, the role of the insurance company. Also, not necessarily your friend when something then blows up. It's the first thing was, I'm really sorry that happened, but you know, you didn't exactly insure for exactly those things. And part of the issues here are, how did the company get to build a lab in a Class A space in an office building? And is that kind of common? You know, somebody in the group said, yeah, it's getting more and more common that people are building labs all over the place, but does all over the place mean in a Class A building? There's also, you know, does all over the place mean, you know, in an office park, in a build, you know, whatever. So I'm not going to go into that detail, but there's one of the issues of what the role of the insurance company is and the extent to which they're going to then examine. I mean, everybody who's ever dealt with an insurance company over anything knows that their first reaction is, no, we didn't do that. You didn't do that. And we're not going to pay. And then they start sitting down. They're not necessarily the people who say, oh, I'm sorry, your lab blew up. So sure, we have all this money ready to give you. They are going to then investigate and find every single possible way of saying, we're just not opening our pockets to you here. So that came up. Then we got into what the role of the board was and the role of one of the board members, you know, who said, you know, that we got to take a more active stance on this. Is this a person who's always been, you know, the more active person on the board, or is this just the new stance given that, you know, they had this, you know, very terrible accident? And I think it was George who put it really very well, that one of the things that happens immediately to the board members is they're immediately going to, in some sequence, begin to say, well, I'm a board member, but this is a big liability here. They are fiduciaries. So I better find out, using the French cover your ass phrase, I got to find out whether or not I have all the notes. Did we discuss everything? Was everything presented to us? The second is that some of the board members may decide they don't want to be part of this anymore. And after they cover their ass, also bail. And then the third scenario would be those board members who say, hey, we're a business. We had an accident. We got to continue to make our product. We got to find an alternative place to do it. You got to work with HR to find people to do that, you know, et cetera. So that shows that the company is, in fact, we manage ourselves. It's sad that we had this accident, but, you know, we're managing ourselves and we're going to move our lab elsewhere and make this product. That was our promise in the first place, which shows that you're a very good company. So that was kind of what we did. Of course, there are a lot of unanswered questions in here. Larry loves cases that have a lot of unanswered or confusing questions. Good for Larry. So that was our group.
Good. Thank you. The next group, Angela, Cindy, Richard, and Robin.
Okay. Angela is the spokesperson for group four. And as others have said, we were surprised that there wasn't more information. But with the information we had, one of the things that we were very surprised with from the very beginning, that the CEO did not take Jane up on her offer to engage a PR, and we say more PR, more crisis management or strategic management team to work alongside her while all of this was going on. So a couple things with the CEO, we noticed that the CEO was working with the mayor and governor, who were kind of throwing the company on the bus a little bit. And the CEO was inwardly focused. So one of the things we felt that the CEO should be outward focused while they appoint someone to really work internally around this particular crisis. So really getting together with the CEO and how will we manage through this crisis with some support and help. We talked a little bit about the crisis team should include insurance, legal, the CEO, board members, and other venture capitalists. We also talked a little bit about the problem had not been defined. So if I were the CEO, I would want to have someone going in and helping to look at what really happened. Is it the landlord's liability because they didn't have the firearms, or, I mean, they didn't have, you know, the sprinklers and the systems in place? Is it our liability, and will insurance actually, you know, help us? We, you know, think it will, but really trying to get someone to help the CEO get under the problem and really understand the problem a little better, because right now we are the problem, according to everyone else, and we need you know, support and help. In addition to someone died, how do we also figure out how to show some compassion around that while we're working through the problem? So we kind of answered the question of, you know, so what should Jane do, being that she was her offer wasn't taken up. And we felt that Jane should insist on either parallel or some contingency group, whether that's with Jane and other venture capitalists, and putting a crisis management team in place to understand the problem, get the right messaging out there, and manage through the situation. There are a lot of missing information in the case, and for a lot of reasons, because when you go through crises, there will be a lot of missing information. We talked about, in addition to the crisis management plans, this is a time we've got to put contingency plans in place. And what are the contingencies? What if this happens? What if it is found that we were liable? What if we're not? What, you know, we have to have someone working on those plans in addition to communication. And we thought that Jane should get together with, if there are other venture firms or other people on the board that she could try to talk with, to try to get a focus around crisis management in this case.
Thank you very much, Angela. The next group is Ari, John, Karen, and Suzanne. Is there a spokesperson for that group? Ari, John, Karen, and Suzanne?
Yes.
It was Suzanne. Suzanne, I think you might be on mute.
Yeah, I keep pushing my video off instead of my sound button. Apologies. So we had many of the same observations, but I think a couple things that, you know, I'll just share to give you some of the color of our discussion. We were alarmed by the unpreparedness of both the CEO and of the board with respect to risk planning, adequate risk planning of any kind, scenario planning, you know, roundtable planning, tabletop, war room plans, all that sort of thing, because we were struck particularly that crises are really likely in a pharmaceutical firm, maybe not the kind of fire that affected RAC, but, you know, there are clinical trial failures, there are people who die in those sorts of things. And so this was a particularly glaring shortcoming given the our industry. And we also talked about the fact that the CEO is really over-relying right now at the writing of this case on legal folks and really underestimating our reputational risk. We were pleased that Jane is pushing a PR response. We thought that was notable given that she is part of the venture firm. And we agreed that a PR response is absolutely essential. And if the CEO doesn't take it up, the board needs to push it, which is similar to, I think, what the last group was talking about. We talked about the similarities of this and the Boeing incident, where so many people died and there was a pure legal response that really failed the stakeholders and, you know, really caused an enormous amount of reputational harm. And we also noted that, you know, the politicians aren't going to protect our reputation, and the insurance company isn't going to protect our reputation. So we need to get to work because we're way behind on the eight ball. We wondered about the culture of the company because it didn't appear that people were really thinking about the community and the employees and the impact that this death and, you know, all this bad press is having on some of those key constituents. And we also recognize that this is something that's really reflects poorly on the board too. So it's absolutely critical that we get plan in place and execute it. And then after the dust settles, we talked about never waste a good crisis and how are we going to learn from this? And we'll evaluate, you know, the CEO will, you know, hopefully the board will be evaluated, you know, from a skills perspective, planning, succession, clearly the crisis management skills that should be relied on as muscle memory when incidents of this sort arise are severely lacking right now. And that's an area of opportunity and it's also absolute necessity. So that was our discussion.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. And our final group consists of Babs, Glenn, Ingrid, and Jim.
This is Glenn Gao. I'm going to go and I want to thank my team for all the work we put they did on this. Our theme was similar in some ways, and yet we went to what we think is really the heart of the challenge here, which is the people. So yes, you should have a PR crisis firm on call, and you should have a PR crisis firm when you have a crisis. That's a given. What's really missing is management and leadership. So there was a lack of risk oversight. The CEO didn't have a plan. The board didn't push for a plan. And both the CEO and the board should have a crisis plan for any black swan event. We can't predict what's going to happen, but we do know things are going to happen. Further, the chairman did not stand up in this crisis. The chairman's role is to support the CEO in a crisis and be a sounding board for the rest of the board. Instead, the chairman just sloughed off that request or communication and said, why don't you send an email to the CEO? And I felt like they didn't do their job, and the chairman could have helped in that scenario, but didn't do their job. Secondly, when we look at the behavior here, we have real questions about the CEO and their ability to continue to be the CEO. So not only did they not have a plan or even push for a plan before this happened, but they didn't understand some of the risks they were involved in. And when they had an opportunity to step forward and work with someone who could help them out of this terrible situation, they didn't take that on. So it begs the question of what is really happening there with the CEO. And finally, we don't really even think the board did their job. The board should have done their job prior to this to have the crisis plan. And now we're even concerned that if we want to replace the CEO now as a result of this, there's probably not even a succession plan. So our perspective was the people are the cause of the issue. And we need to address them probably by removing the CEO and maybe even members of the board.
Excellent. Thank you. Good. I see we have a broad continuum of responses to the case, which is great. Judy, why don't you take it from here? And I'd like you to react to the different teams and also bring your experience to bear in a case like this.
So my first and probably lasting response is everything you think should happen from the time you get this and have a chance to do your role, you don't really have time to do, because this train has left the station and every ticking minute is hurting your reputation and this cascading effects of all of this that you've identified smartly and incisively. But as you know, from my mere 30 years as a journalist, you know that the first thing that happens is nobody's getting a response from the company. The company's not saying anything. They're pulling an ostrich, and already your reputation is sinking further like a stone. And the biggest reason why you need, you know, forethought, having an idea of who you're going to call, plan, that CEO, whether he or she is fantastic or whatever, they don't have time to think. It's the old, you know, the proverbial drinking from a fire hose. And that's why you need the plan. That's why you need people in place. Who's going to be the spokesperson, holding statements already written that could be tweaked, and already knowing, you know, who the legal team is and who you're interfacing with. Because these minutes, it's, you know, it's very corrosive to everything we hold dear as a company, everything. And I particularly want to flag what Angela said, and some others, I think Elizabeth and others have touched on, is you have to find a way to have some humanity in this moment when you have a death. You're whatever you've got planned for what you're going to say, oh, guess what? There's going to be a funeral. There's going to be, you know, all kinds of things that happen that affect what you can. You can't come out and say, we didn't do it. It's not our fault. We're blaming someone else. Right when you've got the widow, you know, on like 6 o'clock news and, you know, getting the story of the security guard or whatever happens. These things have an arc. They have a timeline. The way the press functions, obviously, not even talking about social media, but there's some things that are inviolable once they're in motion, right? You know, you're going to be only able to do so much in the first 48 hours. And I'm not sure who was talking about getting your story out or having the CEO focus externally. Again, it's really hard to get, you know, much of anything cohesive happen during these first 48 hours. And the first 48 hours are crucial. I'm glad someone, I'm forgetting who, flagged the Boeing incident. It is a case I teach, I present, I show the Boeing CEO and as one of the worst, most, you know, biggest fails I've ever seen in PR. Reading from a statement, we are sorry that people died, but we get a gazillion people safely to their destination every day. Wait, you've got hundreds of dead people. You can't talk about the ones that aren't dead. You don't get to do that. So it's so much of this, when you step back and look at it, is common sense. Like, you know, if you were just watching TV, you're like, oh my God, they shouldn't be saying that. And I have to flag the enduring good example of good crisis communications decades later is still the Tylenol cyanide example. And I don't know, nodding heads, clearly, you know, this thing, what, even though that, you know, this product was tampered with and it's why we can't get our pill bottles open to this day, is that they flagged that, you know, that someone had suffered, you know, they did the empathizing, and then we're transparent about, we're going to fix it and we're going to tell you how we're fixing it while we're fixing it. And it seems like something that happened so long ago and seems like such common sense should, you know, like, we shouldn't have to be talking about an old case, right? But it's something that companies, corporations, entities are constantly relearning at their peril. I loved, was it Suzanne who talked about muscle memory and learning from the crisis? Oh man, you know, I would not have so much work if people did that. but unfortunately, we're in a very merciless, the timeline thing is absolutely merciless.
Judy, let me interrupt just for a minute, because you raised the Tylenol thing. J&J was my client during the Tylenol crisis. So I had a chance to sort of look at it from the insider's point of view. And what I saw happening is J&J has these 10 commandments. It's on the wall every time you walk into a J&J office. It's this is what we are all about.
Credo.
And it's the credo. And the number one thing is we are about patient safety. And the last thing in the credo is if we do all of the 9 things above, then the shareholders will benefit. But the shareholders come last. The patients come first. Well, what happened was McNeil Labs, which was a division of J&J when the Tylenol came in, the president of McNeil Labs unilaterally declared that we're gonna take every bottle of Tylenol off the shelves. And he did not consult with the CEO of J&J. And when the CEO found out about it, he was absolutely livid and wanted to fire the president of J&J, of McGlinnell Labs. However, the president of McGlinnell Labs justified the decision based on the credo. You know, for those of you in higher education, this is equivalent to you make a decision and then you base it on academic freedom. There are just some things you don't touch. And in J&J, it's the credo. Since he used the credo to justify his actions, the president of J&J had to back off. And then, of course, as things developed, the president of J&J got all the credit for the decision and became a hero, got all these honorary doctorates, and became the spokesperson for good communications. And that's his reputation. But really, the real learning is you got to have a real credo that's not just a bunch of words on the paper, but something that is so important that if you justify your actions based on that, on those statements, it's understood the CEO has got to back off.
All right, can I just make one comment? The fact that they had a credo speaks to the thing that came up in our group, which is that you don't just let things happen to you. I mean, they had a credo. They kind of, that credo was sort of like a plan, a roadmap in the event something went wrong.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about this is I think a lot of companies come up with credos that they are, arrived at often through market research and through how the company is going to look. I'm not sure that all the credos are as genuine as it sounds like J&J's was. And I've been party to many discussions about company missions and so on. And it really is kind of just words. Other times, people will dig in. I tend to find sort of the shorter credos tend to be the more effective and kind of sincere, at least, again, my small data points. But I think it's a really important observation. I think the conclusion is it's not just having a credo. If you do it right, it's genuine, it's thoughtful, it reflects the true kind of sentiments of the company's culture. And then most importantly, it's reinforced. Then I think it can act as a guiding principle. And I think that's a really important point.
Your point, Fortune magazine ran an article 1 month before the Enron scandal that identified the Enron mission statement as being one of the top three mission statements in the country. Wow.
Okay. Larry, what was the first bullet point in J&J's credo?
If I recall, the first bullet point was that we're a healthcare company, and our first obligation is to take care of patients and support
health. Kind of ironic, given the whole talcum powder case, mm-hmm. class action.
Yeah.
The other thing about crisis plans and, is again, a lot, you can have a plan that sits on a shelf. No one knows what's in it. They haven't done those tabletop exercises. They haven't revisited it. They haven't updated it, so it's an active, effort that needs to be underway.
And those plans need to be revisited on an ongoing basis as things change. I know in our business, we used to do disaster recovery plans. What happens if your systems in certain countries you couldn't get to, where do you rotate them off to, or what happens with the staff and those same kind of thing, if a disaster is happening, are your plans up to date so you can go into action pretty quickly?
Yeah. And we include, I always recommend that they be included in new board member orientation and new executive orientation
so that everybody, you know, knows what to do, who gets called first, et cetera. You don't have to find that book.
And if you're working remotely, it's on a shelf that you're nowhere near, right?
I think it's a mindset. I mean, someone using the word safety is a very narrow thing here. Safety is not a manual. Safety is a mindset.
So Judy, I know we're limited on time. It'd be good to hear kind of what did transpire, what happened, like what steps, what actions, what's the Paul Harvey, you know, what's the rest of the story? Are you able to share that or
yeah, So this is based on, for those of you that are in the Boston area, there was the Columbia gas explosion here some years back that affected not just the people, you know, the one person who died, but they basically shut off the heat for the whole Merrimack Valley. So it was, you know, it was a very widespread impact. And it was a malfunction. The shutoff was a button that didn't get pushed in Columbus, Ohio. And to have a system that was reliant on that was, anyone could have seen how that could go wrong, right? So there was a ton of insurance. Just about every house in Lawrence, Massachusetts was rebuilt. There were a lot of missteps along the way. And I think I can say here that my firm was very much involved. We you know, worked out of trailers in Lawrence for months, forever it seemed. but the a lot of the press releases, a lot was being done by outside counsel in Chicago, and there wasn't communication. You know, there were real gaps in communication, and I learned a lot from that. That if you're not, you know, everyone has to be talking to each other. And so this whole, you know, there wasn't a plan in place. There, you know, the company, the parent company survived. Columbia Gas is now part of Eversource. And it was a real punching bag by the governor and by the mayor and US senators. And, you know, it was the body blows were relentless.
In the time we have left, I'd like you to comment on, I think there's a theme in the case that some of the groups caught, and that is the inevitable tension between the legal and insurance side and the communications and crisis management side, where the insurance and the legal, their initial inclination is to say as little as possible, because anything you say could be misconstrued, could be turned against you, just shut up until we figure this out. And then you have the crisis communications, so you can't wait until you're comfortable. You got to seize the moment, and you got to be smart about it. Can you comment about that? Because that makes, because framing it in that way doesn't make it a personal issue. It makes it a kind of a structural issue that can be predicted by board members.
Yeah, and I think fundamentally, like we were out there dealing with press, and the president of my firm and myself had a lot of good media relationships that mitigated, you know, some of the what was going on. But ultimately, the to my mind, the most important thing is that these entities talk to each other. And, you know, the tension can be very positive. It can be a good tension, because if you have a meeting of the minds and you see each other's point and you say, well, yes, but we could do this and so forth. So much, I worked with lawyers all the time, and I think it's a very good tension. But when everyone's kept apart, and then you don't know exactly what was said, you know, it's really much harder to serve the goals that are really shared goals. And sometimes it's not that you're going to say so much, but you can say something, and you can find a way to humanize the situation. You can find a way to show that, you know, the company's doing the best it can, to address the problem. And there are ways to do it without, you know, having a lot of words that are going to be used against you in a courtroom later on.
Before we adjourn, does anybody have any other questions for Judy?
Larry, if I just add something, having been in that situation of managing sort of the legal versus the PR, again, you know, ultimately what you save in a lawsuit, you could lose in revenue and customers and so on and so forth. So, you know, I've been in companies, I've been fortunate with the management team, and the board's philosophy was, look, we will take our lumps. You know, we will say, you know, we're not going to say nothing. We're not going to limit. We didn't really have a debate when we say nothing, but we weren't driven so much by say as little as possible for legal reasons. We were, you know, let's kind of speak to the facts and deal with, you know, deal with the situation. And I think that notion of looking at the cost of the business as a whole will help you strike that balance in those situations.
Good. Thanks very much.
I sort of add, Larry, that, I mean, the case that you're talking about, Judy, if it was, NiSource was the parent company, correct? And so you added this.
NiSource,
You added this twist about venture capital, and that wasn't really the case. But I guess if you're in a situation where venture capital has 20, 30, 40% of the company, it is a different situation than a publicly owned company with this particular subsidy. But I think the other point, which has been made, is to be very clear on sort of roles and responsibilities. Who's going to talk to the press? Who's going to do this? Who's going to do that? And to be upfront, as has been pointed out, to sort of, if something bad happens, do we have a plan and working through it and have a plan that people have been bought into? But I think because a friend of mine was the director of NiSource, and we talked a lot about the situation.
Angela said something about using having contingency plans, and one thing I would agree 100%, but I would move them up to have contingency plans all along, not a contingency plan when the event happens.
That's
just a comment.
Agree. Judy, I want to ask a question. Did the CEOs stay in the forefront during this crisis, or did they bring someone else in to help them manage through the communication? What happened there? What happened to that point?
Well, the parent company NiSource did, you know, those executives did come.
Present, okay.
And that they served the company well. And,
okay.
And, you know, you won't be surprised that the head of Columbia Gas is no longer.
Yeah.
Yeah, off
his job. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And I think that the venture capital piece of your story is something we've touched on, but I do, having a venture capital backed company implies that it's a relatively young company. So the fact that maybe they haven't addressed crisis management scenarios prior is not so surprising. And then the other piece of that is that the venture capitalist is usually the largest stakeholder, and that's why they may have an outsized role as opposed to board members in a larger company or a public company.
Yeah, you had to make it interesting.
Right.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Judy, for your case and for your wisdom. I want to thank everybody for your participation today. We will not be meeting next month. Our next Seat at the Table program is going to be in October. You will be getting notices about that way before that time. So have a nice and wonderful rest of the summer. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.